This is Hidden Killers Week in Review.
A look back at the most prolific stories of the week.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Do you think she's starting to feel the writing on the wall here? Do you think she herself is feeling like she's being backed into the corner? And do you think the defense team is starting to feel that way too?
You know, yes. And I think leading up to this retrial, some would say Kara Reid was kind of brazen. She was kind of audacious. She was kind of out there. You know, she's talking and she seems to be enjoying the media attention and being her version of charismatic. And then once you get into that gauntlet, things change. Sometimes the gravity of what is going on in that courtroom and the direction it's going can sort of land in your chest and you feel it. And I can't help but wonder if Karen Reed is like, hey, this isn't going like the first one went.
I wonder, do you think she's had a moment or do you think it's just been kind of a slow build, lobster in the pot? I wonder if there's one thing that was just like, I mean, she's had her reactions in court. That's certainly there where it's you can tell she's not happy about some of the rulings that have come down and what's been played in court. But I'm wondering, I don't know. I mean, was there a moment or just a slow build on this one?
You know, I think there could have been a few moments. Yeah. One was the digital forensics expert who did a locational analysis of John O'Keefe's phone and at least for the most part said that it was very likely to be outside of the home, though there was some cross-examination. And then on top of that, I think Burgess's testimony was problematic for the defense. There was a recent forensic criminalist on the stand who purported to match up some of the plastic debris found on John O'Keefe with the broken taillight from Karen Reed's vehicle. And so I can't help but wonder if these, you know, high points for the prosecution are starting to kind of punch Karen Reed in the gut and she's starting to really come to grips with what's happened.
And they're really going into detail this round and really explaining not just, okay, the expert says that these microscopic pieces of taillight were found in his clothing, as you just mentioned there, Christina Hanley, the forensic trace expert that was testifying the other day, but going into just how detailed that these things were in there, basically stating to a layperson, there's no way you're going to be able to plant these things this way. I mean, it's just, you're not. It's just, it's not going to look like this. You'd have to literally, it would have to come at you in a certain way and a certain volition and a certain energy force to get these things embedded into the clothing at the microscopic level that they were. Not exactly the, well, let's take some chunks of taillight and plant it over here, that whole theory. But again, there doesn't seem to be anything that the defense won't try to believe that the cops somehow microscopically planted tiny shards of taillight in his clothing. Okay, if you want to believe that, that's lovely, but I'm going to say it's probably not true. How that was a damning piece, I thought, as well, especially just to a jury that doesn't know the full breadth of this case as the rest of us do, you know, supposedly. But they're hearing that for the first time. They're hearing the timestamp matches up. They're hearing the hatred that Karen seemed to have for him in those voicemails. They're hearing her basically admit to the timestamps matching where she thought he died. And now we have pieces of the damn broken taillight in his clothes. This is not, I mean, this is not a real complicated whodunit here. This is more like, wake up.
Yeah, I feel you. And you know, I think it's in part a function of the new special prosecutor, Hank Brennan, and the tight ship that he has been at the helm of during this retrial. You know, in the first trial, there was a sense that there were dots that weren't always connected, and so I think Hank Brennan saw that and he said, hey, how do we overcome this conspiracy argument? How do we present a more ironclad coherent story to this jury so they can understand and believe what we're telling them happened? And I think he's done a really good job of that, like you said, going into detail about the nuance, about sort of the smaller aspects that when, you know, looked at under a microscope, really kind of help show that there's no opening for reasonable doubt in a lot of those analyses.
Obviously, it's the job of her defense to introduce reasonable doubt. That seems to be probably the only way she's going to be getting off here, is trying to find some shard, pardon the pun, of reasonable doubt that maybe will resound with something. But you have to walk that fine line when you're a defense attorney of not insulting the intelligence of the jurors, I would think, because nothing kills anybody liking you faster is, you know, insulting their intelligence, or even worse, doing it in a real kind of covert way, passive aggressive way, where we're not going to quite tell you you're an idiot, but we think you might be an idiot. So we're going to frame it this way, even though you're not an idiot. One of those things I thought was interesting, the way that the defense was trying to introduce reasonable doubt into the taillight shards, was the stressing that you can't say conclusively, I believe, that these shards of taillight embedded in his clothes came from this specific taillight. They're the same type of plastic. They're the same color of the taillight. They look like they could be, but there's no way to like forensically put them together like a puzzle, because they're just tiny little pieces. And really stressing that, I felt that, I mean, I get what they're doing, but was that the right road to go down, to say, well, yes, it could, it's the same make, it's the same this and that, but it could have been another Lexus SUV of the exact same make and model that maybe slammed into John O'Keefe and implanted these pieces into his clothing. That could be a possibility, right? That's where the word reasonable comes into play when it comes to reasonable doubt.
Exactly. I mean, you got to be careful on the defense side with what you're trying to sell to a jury, because they don't want their intelligence insulted. You know, think about if you're like at work and there's some kind of dispute, and the first person says, you know, hey, yeah, that this guy was making me feel uncomfortable and harassing me, and then the guy says, actually, it was a complete body double, and you can't prove that I don't have a twin, or that I haven't been cloned or something. You know, you got to. Well, that might be theoretically true.
Yeah.
Is that really what you want to try to sell to a jury? And could that damage your own credibility by making that argument?
Walk me through, because I'm trying to figure out Karen's argument on the piece of glass that was, or some of the pieces of glass that were found on her bumper and the taillight, that they're not pieces of glass that fit into the puzzle physically of the drinking glass. They're tiny shards. So they're pieces, again, that really can't be quite placed as to where they are. Now, granted, it's already been said that John O'Keefe left the car basically with two drinks, from what we understand. Her vodka tonic, and essentially he had one too. That's, from all of the minutiae, what I think many of us have come to conclude. Maybe if it's just one, it doesn't, not whatever it may be. What does it matter at this point if there's shards of glass that maybe couldn't be found to be put into the puzzle of the broken glass? Is there another mystery glass we're talking about? Is it the second glass? What? Because Karen seems to be stuck on this, too, when out of court the other day making some statements of, well, they didn't know where that glass was from. What? Okay. And I mean, maybe I'm missing this here. What's the argument?
You know, it's a bit of a head scratch on that one. The argument might be, let me just try to muck up the facts here as best I can.
Yeah.
And hopefully that will lead to some confusion that might translate into reasonable doubt. Because, yeah, you know, if there was a second glass, I don't know, is defense going to argue that the Alberts, you know, beat John O'Keefe with multiple glasses? It really starts to unravel and fall apart when you scrutinize it. And that's the problem for Karen Reed's defense.
Because this mystery glass really doesn't have anything to do with anything. Nobody's saying he got hit in the head with a glass. I mean, there's the neurosurgeon said, look, this injury is from falling on the back of his head. It's not from a glass being chucked at his head, because there's no contusion like you'd have with a hammer or a flying cocktail glass. So I don't know where the glass is from. If I guess one could possibly assume that the glass is from the drinking glass, it's just shards that you can't really place. Again, what does it matter? It has nothing to do. It's look, there's fire over here. Look over here. Glass, shiny. Don't pay attention to this. Is that really what we're dealing with on the glass right now?
It could be that. It could be something like, hey, the prosecution has a duty to explain to you what happened and to explain what the evidence is and where it comes from. And if there are things they can't explain, that's a problem. And that could lead to some kind of doubt, and that could translate into reasonable doubt. I suspect it's going to be some kind of vague argument like that, saying, hey, prosecution has the responsibility of telling you what happened here and what this stuff is, and they can't do it, so don't trust them on other stuff.
Would her better of option had just been to kind of, if in fact she's guilty, if she knew about this, just to have said, look, I was drunk. This was horrible. I feel horrible. Not intentional. And have pled something early on versus this. I mean, if you're to look back in time, what would you have said to her?
You know, I think that this, from defense perspective, could easily be characterized as just a horribly tragic accident. That it's something that no one intended. You know, horrible stuff happens. It was a blizzard out, that they were engaged in this sort of chaotic conflict. Emotions are running high, and something really horrible happened. And you know, to try to broker a plea before the first trial, or even possibly better, after the mistrial, because then defense has some leverage to say, hey, y'all don't, you know, you weren't able to bring it home the first time. You might not be able to bring it home the second time. Let's meet in the middle somewhere. You know, give her 2 years in jail or something and call it good. I wonder if that was explored. I don't know.
Well, the consequences will be faced shortly, and that may be freedom or it may be a lot longer behind bars.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today.